online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Larissa Smith on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
G'day. A shortage looming for the state's biggest hazelnut grower.
So last year we had an Australian record crop, and this year we're 40% down on that. So it's quite a significant drop.
And a three-year trial investigating adverse impacts of covering cherry crops.
What's actually leading to the fruit going soft? Is that because of the rain covers? Or is it more growing conditions that we're not anticipating, we're not aware of, and then going, okay, can we actually then manipulate our rain covers to actually get around some of those conditions as well?
Cherry research ahead, and hazelnut production hit by adverse weather last spring. It's a familiar story across the ag sector this season. We'll drop into that nut grove in the north shortly. Hi there, Larissa Smith with you for Wednesday's edition of the Country Hour. We're also talking tulip bulbs. There's some big growers in the state, and production nationwide is also down there. And of course, the latest livestock prices from Richard Bailey, a little closer to one. Feel free to text into the program and share your thoughts too on any of our stories. 0438 922 936 is the number. 0438 922 936. Well, let's start with dairy, because the new season for milk prices is just around the corner. Dairy farmers are urging companies to reflect the rise in costs to produce the milk on their farms. I spoke to Andrew Aldridge, the Vice Chair with the Tas Farmers Dairy Committee, a short time ago.
The difference leading up into this year is the market increase in costs that are being faced on farm due to the global volatility that we're facing at the moment. The price rises in fuel and freight, fertiliser, energy and feed have climbed incredibly sharply over the last 3 to 4 months. And moving into the negotiation season, or the price release season, we're asking that transparency is put there, and a recognition that the entire supply chain needs to step up to assist farmers to ensure that the costs that we're facing on farm don't stop at farm gate, that they are able to be absorbed and move through the entire supply chain.
Are you hopeful that milk companies will reflect those increase in costs in the next milk price?
The reality of the situation is that if we don't see the companies recognising the importance of their position to assist us with the way we handle those rising costs, will mean that farmers will be faced with some significant decisions about how they operate over the next 12 months. Prices would indicate that fertiliser prices alone would have doubled, and therefore we will require a higher payment just to maintain our ability to operate in a way that is sustainable.
So are you talking about reducing herd size, cutting back on milk production as a whole? Could it lead to that?
Farmers will be faced. Oh yes, very definitely. Farmers will be faced with some pretty tough decisions. I mean, we've got relatively high cattle prices at the moment. We've got a level of uncertainty. We're seeing farmers have already started budgeting on what they're going to price. Some rough indications on average nitrogen use in Tasmania, with average responses, would indicate that the lift in urea price has possibly even lifted our cost of production, the cost of production on an average dairy farm, by about 60 cents. So you've either got to get more milk out of, or more production out of that application, or the consideration is well, where do we have to pull back to a point that we limit the amount of exposure we have to the external costs?
So there has been some early positive signals from one company, Lactalese Mainland, which is taken ownership of Fonterra. What have they offered?
They have announced yesterday that they are offering a temporary support payment from the 1st of May to assist their farmers to to navigate the rising costs of 64 cents a kilo milk solids, which is a welcome sign from a couple of players, because it's not just Lactalis Mainland Dairy, but also their parent company Lactalis have announced the same thing. And that is a welcome move to recognise that they have recognised that their responsibility in helping us with this through this time. What we now would be asking is that the conversations are had as to whether these support payments really reflect the real cost that is being borne, and how these costs are being distributed amongst the supply chain. So not only undertaking the actions they have, but also working with us and talking with us about and providing a greater level of transparency as to how people are, how the entire supply chain is assisting so that the burden isn't left at the farm gate.
The companies have had to endure an increase in cost too. They've got to get the milk to the factories, and the tankers would be churning through very expensive diesel to get it there, plus additional other freight costs embedded in getting the product to market. So that's probably one of their arguments.
And I mean, it's a very valid point. The issue is where does that cost go? And I suppose that's why we need to have these conversations, that it's got to go all the way through the supply chain, and that
to the supermarkets.
As supermarkets, consumers, we need the level of transparency to ensure that the pain isn't felt just in one spot.
Andrew Aldridge, Vice Chair of the TAS Farmers Dairy Committee and a farmer at Branxholme in the state's northeast. We'll return to dairy later in the program, looking at new Australian breeding values to help farmers reduce stillbirths in calves. That's after news headlines. Well, what a difference a year makes. Last season, hazelnut growers Hazel Bray produced the largest crop in Australia. Fast forward 12 months, and owner Christy McLeod is looking at a 40% drop in yield, forcing the business to make some pretty tough decisions, including closing their farm shop at Hagley.
So last spring, there was a sudden stratospheric warming event in Antarctica. When it's a severe one, like it was last spring, it created significant winds, cooler temperatures, more frequent rain, which has interrupted the growing cycle of at least two of the three varieties of our nuts.
What prevented the trees from growing the yields that you're used to seeing?
So hazelnut trees are very much temperature driven. They'll start coming out in spring when they've got enough warm hours. At the opposite end in autumn, they will drop their leaves and go into their winter dormancy, and they will pollinate after a certain amount of chill hours. So they're quite temperature driven, and they like their comfortable windows. Difference with this spring was we had a nice autumn, so they kind of started, and then September came and we had those horrible winds and those cooler temperatures, which went through October, and so the trees just pretty much just stopped and thought, yeah, no, we'll keep sleeping for a bit longer. And we missed the window where they like to create the nut itself and create how many nuts are going to grow in the cluster. And so those winds that we kept getting through until December whipped the tree branches significantly all that time and kept scarring all the fresh leaf, which creates the energy that the tree needs to create the nut crop. And so that reduced the nut crop that the tree decided it wanted to grow. So two of our varieties sort of gave up this year and had a rest. The third variety was all right. We don't have enough of that third variety, the late variety, to make up the difference for the rest of the orchard.
So how much are yields down?
So last year we had an Australian record crop, and this year we're 40% down on that. So it's quite a significant drop. All of the advice that we've had and discussions we've had all lead to that it's a once-off. I mean, the severe weather event in Antarctica happens around about every 22 years, so we shouldn't see this for another couple of decades. Fingers crossed. We need to treat this like the trees have had a rest or a gap year, and expect them to, you know, be right back into it next year with the next season. So, I mean, the the leaf tests that we've just done have come back really good, which is unusual usually because we're normally quite depleted after having a heavy crop, and this year the trees are quite healthy. So we know that there's nothing really wrong out there. It's just a one-off event that happens every couple of decades, and we've just got to manage what we can for the next 12 months and then look forward to a bumper crop next year.
But as a result, you've had to make some quite big changes within the business of how you run things. What are you doing?
We've really expanded our sales over the last couple of years, and especially on our online store. And we've actually grown our online store last year. We sold more nuts through our online store than what we've grown this year. So we really have to trim back where we're selling our nuts and make sure that we're selling them in the most cost-effective way and the most profitable way that we can, so that we can manage the rest of our business expenses over the next 12 months until we get another good crop. So this year we've just made the decision to close our farm shop for the next 15 months until the next crop is ready to be sold. So even though we're harvesting now, we actually don't release this crop of nuts until about 3 months after we finish harvesting, because they taste better. They mature like a good cheese or a good wine, take a little bit to become that nice nutty flavour that people expect of our product. We probably won't reopen the shop until the next crop is ready to go and tastes good.
So that means you have to let go a couple of staff?
So we have 1.5 full-time equivalent people here at the moment. And, yeah, with no shop open and not much to produce this year, we haven't got enough work for them to stay. So we've been hunting around for them for another position. We think we've found them a position, or we've found them, something to get them through. We're pretty crushed that we have to let them go. We've got a really good team, and I'm going to be pretty bored talking to myself all day now. There's no one else to chat to. I mean, we still have our Salamanca stall that we own, so we sort of have to go there until we run out of nuts. And then we frequent Farmgate Market on a reasonably regular basis. That's Mick's job now, husband's job now. So, and he'll be doing other work in spring and summer in contract fodder and stuff. So he probably won't be available to do those shifts during spring and summer. So, yeah, it's kind of naturally going to scale back those a little bit, because we just won't have enough to take. We'll run out of nuts this season.
What about fertiliser? Are you worried about where you're going to get it from and how much?
We have had those conversations. I think it's MAP that there isn't any of at the moment. So we normally use that post-harvest. But this year the trees are so healthy that you actually don't have to use it this year. So we're going to get away with that. It was kind of a bit of a lucky, we've got to look on the bright side. I mean, we don't want this war to go on for too much longer, because we want to get back to normal next spring. I feel sorry for the northern growers that are, trying to plant now, because that would be really tough decisions. Going into our quiet part of the season, we'll be dormant. We don't do much now until about late August, and most of that is available and made in Australia. So we're sort of confident, but we are pre-booking all our foliars so that we make sure, because they're the most essential ones for growing the crop during the season. And so we are pre-booking those now so that we make sure that we've got the resources we need to get a good crop next year.
How have your customers responded to the news that you will have less nuts to sell?
I sent out an email to our Nut Club yesterday, and I think I've had around 30 or 40 emails back with really, really strong support and, hope that we'll get through this okay, and next year will be even better, and it will. It'll just be that we ran out early. So trying to slow down sales by holding back our wholesale and closing the shop will let our nuts stretch further through the season, and we really hope that we can maintain our really regular people that buy every month. We hope that we can maintain enough stock for them, but we'll try not to get new customers. But we just seem to attract people all the time. So, yeah, so, we'll do our best to maintain everybody's snacks for another 12 months. But, it's a short window this year. We have got a small amount of crop.
That's Christy McLeod from Hazelbray Hazelnuts at Hagley in the States North. And other growers across Tassie are also reporting a big drop in production too. We're chatting to the Weather Bureau next.
Look at me.
Anne Edmonds, Kitty Flanagan, Magda Zabanski, and so many more.
Good morning, everyone.
No one cares.
In comedy gems like Fisk, Kath and Kim, and Bad Company.
This is fun.
No, thank you.
Comedy that leaves an impression. ABC iView.
Keeping you updated every day. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Larissa Smith.
At 20 past 12, let's check the latest on the weather with Ursula Connor from the Bureau. Hi, Ursula.
Good afternoon, Larissa.
Any rainfall to report?
Look, we had that cold front sort of make its way across the state yesterday, so that brought a few showers, especially into sort of the western parts of the state. The highest totals there were, of course, on the peak, sort of Mount Rea, Darwin Dam, Lake Margaret, all recording around 18 millimetres. But outside of that, sort of between 2 and 5 millimetres into the west there and through the southeast, just a millimetre or two close to the Hobart area and down over the peninsula as well. But into today, we've just sort of slipped back into that westerly flow. So we are seeing some lighter showers continue to push into the western and sort of far southern parts of the state, but only a millimetre or two really recording through those areas, Larissa.
And what about for the rest of the week? What's on the horizon?
Yeah, well, as we move into tomorrow, we're going to start to see some sort of gusty northwesterly winds develop tomorrow morning. That's ahead of a front which is going across the state during the afternoon and evening. So that looks like it'll bring some decent showers, especially into sort of the western and northern parts of the state, maybe just extending through the far south as well, but then sort of petering out by the time the front makes its way through to the east coast. Then behind that, a bit of a blustery sort of southwesterly change on Friday, going to bring some very cold and gusty conditions again. Those showers will sort of shift back to the west and far south, but falling as snow above around 900 metres, it looks like, on Friday morning. So another sort of chilly start to the weekend, but the conditions do sort of ease as we move into Saturday. We're going to have a ridge of high pressure sit over the state really for most of the weekend. So conditions are looking pretty fine and settled, but we will still see that cold air lingering. So some chilly mornings, particularly on Saturday, and into Sunday morning, we could even be seeing some inland frosts, Larissa.
Well, it is that time for it, isn't it? You know, we're midway through autumn. It had to happen.
It does indeed.
What's happening if you're taking the boat out this afternoon?
Yeah, look, a bit windy out there, and it just sort of gets windier over sort of this evening and into tomorrow. So at the moment, we're looking at those west to southwesterly winds around 15 to 25 knots, reaching about 35 knots through the south there. And then as we see that front approaching, those winds tending west to northwesterly through this evening, and we'll see them around 20 to 30 knots tomorrow, increasing to 30 to 35 knots by the afternoon, reaching 40 knots about the south. Swell-wise, through the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly around 3 to 4 metres. Through the north, a northwesterly around 1 to 1.5 metres. And in the east, a south to southwesterly around 1 to 2 metres. Cape Sorrel is currently sitting at 3.8 metres with a max wave height of 5.3. And Maria Island has just frozen on me. How about that?
Never mind.
We've got it. 1.2 metres.
Terrific. Any warnings to report?
Look, for today, we just have the coastal wind warning. So that's for the southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay around to Low Rocky Point. But keeping an eye on those warnings for tomorrow, expecting to see some gales picking up, especially through those southern coastal waters, and that strong wind warning extending throughout most of the state.
Thanks, Ursula.
Thanks, Larissa.
Ursula Connor there at the Weather Bureau with the latest. Are rain covers on cherry crops, commercial cherry crops, responsible for soft root? Well, trials testing this theory. That's up next. A landmark trial is underway in northern Tasmania to determine whether rain covers for cherries are impacting their quality. Tasmania produces some of the highest quality cherries in the world, and farmers warn a dip could collapse the $66 million sector. Mackenzie Archer has this story.
In the Tamar Valley, researchers are trying to understand if cherry rain covers, which have been widely adopted by growers in the state, are impacting the quality of the fruit, or whether other factors like climate change are to blame. Dr. Letitia Rees is a tree crop physiologist at the University of Tasmania and is heading up the three-year trial.
Climate change is creating a real double challenge for cherry growers in Tasmania. We are seeing hotter and drier conditions during fruit development, which stress the trees. And at the same time, more intense rainfall close to harvest, which increases fruit cracking. So growers are trying to manage both tree stress and fruit damage at the same time.
Can you tell me about the new trial you're undertaking and also the experimental site you have set up in the Tamar Valley?
So we have set up a field trial in a commercial cherry orchard in the Tamar Valley, working with the industry. We are comparing trees grown under rain covers with trees grown in open conditions. And we are measuring light, temperature, and humidity at the branch level, at the fruit zone, and looking at how the fruit responds across the season. The trial started this season, and we expect to build results over the next 2 years.
So rain covers are commonly used in Tasmania for cherries. What has prompted some of these new concerns?
Rain covers have been widely adopted because they work very well to protect fruits, but we now know they also reduce light and change temperature and humidity around the tree. So what we are trying to do now is quantify how much solar radiation is actually being lost under these covers and how that affects fruit quality. That's something we still don't fully understand under Tasmania conditions, and that's what this project is aiming to answer.
There has been some concern in the industry that the rain covers could be impacting fruit quality, but Brent McClintock from Pinnacle Fine Foods wants evidence to back this up. He can't see a future without protective covers.
The industry identified that we needed to know more about rain covers. And for some of us, including myself, we see them as a very important part of our industry going forwards. To the point where I like for my personal belief is I don't see a future growing cherries without rain covers. But there's so much superstition, we needed to actually find some information out. So as an industry, we sort of got together and put together a project that has gone through like Hort Innovation and that process to then go out for consultation and then has been approved. Now the teachers delivering part of it in Tasmania for the Tasmanian growers.
Were there any concerns or potential impacts of the covers that prompted this new trial?
I've been one of the biggest naysayers of rain covers over the years because they have a stigma attached to them about making fruit soft. And for us to get the prices we need or get the high returns overseas, we need to have firm, crunchy fruit. And so doing anything that could possibly hamper that has been a very big, sort of a big negative. And that's what one of the things we're finding now about rain covers is there's been this stigma that rain covers will make your fruit soft, whereas now we're getting into it, we're finding, okay, no, we can make fruit soft, but I can make fruit soft with rain covers or without rain covers. It's now going, what's actually leading to the fruit going soft? And is that part of it? Is that because of the rain covers? Or is it more growing conditions that we're not anticipating, we're not aware of? And then going, okay, can we actually then manipulate our rain covers to actually get around some of those conditions as well?
Do you think climate change is playing a part in this?
Climate change is going to be the biggest challenge we face going forwards. But I see rain covers being a huge thing about us managing that, because we need to high winds, rainfall, that type of thing. We need to have ways of managing or mitigating their effects on our crop. So rain covers, windbreaks, all that stuff is becoming a lot more important to our industry. As our weather becomes more severe, like as we're from climate change, it's not necessarily that things are getting hotter, but when we do get a rain event now, it's a big rain event rather than a small rain event. If we get winds that now are 100k an hour versus 40k an hour type stuff, so everything's just becoming more extreme.
Tasmania achieves some of the highest prices and is known for its premium fruit. If we lost that reputation or title, what would that mean?
You'd see the Tasmanian cherry industry disappear, essentially. The domestic market's a big part of what we do, but our profitability comes largely from our export markets. That's where that premium is. And if we can't deliver that market high quality, big fruit, good flavour, tick all those boxes, we're going to get gobbled up by the likes of Chile, who can produce a whole lot of fruit very, very cheaply, and we're not going to be able to compete with them. So therefore, those export markets will disappear, and that, or suddenly the industry that has been quite strong and quite vibrant and has the profitability to innovate like we are now around rain covers, all of that profitability disappears, and it'll be a few small orchards around supplying the local market, and that will be it.
And the trial's in its early stages now. I guess what would you like to see it achieve?
I'd like to see it answer some of these questions or sort of get rid of some of these superstitions that we have around rain covers by saying, oh, look, there's no difference in temperature, there's no real difference in humidity with some of these new rain cover systems we're using. There is no reason our fruit will be soft under rain cover, so hopefully we can get more people on board, or there's more knowledge and less hysteria around them, so to speak.
That's Brent McClintock from Pinnacle Fine Foods at Sidmouth in the Tamar Valley, ending that report from Mackenzie Archer. And data from the first round of the trial is expected to be released to growers in late July.
Join us on Anzac Day across the ABC. From Gallipoli and Villers-Bretonneux to the Dawn Service and March in your capital city.
We will remember them.
On ABC Radio, TV and iView, and on ABC Listen.
You're with Larissa Smith on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Still to come, have you got spring bulbs at your place, like tulips? It seems nationally they're in short supply.
It's not wholly unusual to be out of tulips at this time of year, but we're out earlier this year than, yeah, we would have liked, shall we say. We could have sold more.
We're going to find out why from one of the state's biggest growers. There's a day for everything, and did you know it's International Banana Day? Have you had your nana today? Concerns about potential banana imports from the Philippines also on the program a little later on. But let's continue now with dairy, starting with dairy genetics. Two new Australian breeding values are being published to help dairy farmers reduce stillbirths in calves. Currently, between 5 and 7% of calves are stillborn or die within the first day, making it the leading cause of death for the dairy herd. Data Gene Limited stakeholder relations specialist Peter Thurn says while many environmental factors contribute to the risk of stillbirth, genetics also plays a role.
There's lots of reasons a calf can die, but stillbirth is the biggest one. We also know that there is a genetic component to stillbirth, and that's the angle that we take. I mean, obviously, everything that we look at is a combination of genetics and management. There's some management things you can do around observations and and that sort of thing, but we can also identify differences between animals that are due to their genetics, and that's what we're trying to exploit here, is identifying animals who are better than average for stillbirth or calf survival, if you wanted to put it in a positive sense. So when we know that there's a genetic component to this, as animal breeders, we can do something about it. And that's why we've created the new ABVs around stillbirth, so that farmers can select positively to reduce the level of stillbirth in their herds.
How heritable is this trait? How strongly can we select for it?
So it's what we would describe as probably a mildly heritable trait. So it sits somewhere between 10 and 20% in terms of heritability. So that's pretty strong in terms of our, you know, in terms of our ability to make genetic gain for this. If we contrast that with a trait like daughter fertility, it's down around 5%. And we've made massive gains in daughter fertility over the last 20 years. For a trait that's 5% heritable, this trait's at least double that, if not more. So the scope to make genetic gain and make change for stillbirth is quite significant.
How long do you think it would take until we see some improvement in that? I think you said it was like between 5 and 7% stillbirth mortality, right? How long do you think until that could be shrunk?
Well, it's actually been improving even without having these direct breeding values, because stillbirth is highly correlated with calving ease. And over the last period of time, we've done a very good job of improving calving ease in Holsteins in particular. And we've been finding that the stillbirth rate has been going down over that period. The beauty of having a breeding value that is actually targeting what we want, it's always, from a breeding sense, it's always better to do something, work on something directly than indirectly. And while calving ease has an indirect effect on stillbirth, selecting for improved stillbirth picks up all the other things that calving ease doesn't provide you. I think the opportunity here for us is to increase the rate of genetic gain that we're making for stillbirth. And, you know, the thing about this is it's the turnaround time in terms of making those gains is relatively short, because we're talking about using semen this year and then 9 months later we have a calf born. And so you can actually see the results of this fairly quickly if you're using animals that are better than you have been for stillbirth traits.
Peter Thurn from Data Genes speaking there to Timu King. Well, they're stunning in spring, but tulips can be tricky to grow. And around Australia, there's a shortage of bulbs. Beck Pridham caught up with Dave Roberts-Thompson at his tulip farm in the state's northwest to find out why.
Yeah, so we're still quite a lot going on the farm. We're currently grading our tulip bulbs, getting them ready for planting. Normally we'd do that in May, but it's important we get through that now. We've just finished putting in most of our cover crops at the moment and doing the minimal amount of groundwork that we're planning to do this year.
We're hearing that around Australia right now that there's a tulip bulb shortage. Why is that?
It's a good question. There is a bit of a shortage going around at the moment. There's still like a pretty keen interest in gardening in general off the back of COVID. So garden products and bulbs, you know, you could say it was one of those, were really hot property through COVID. Like it was a good time and people got back into their gardens. And although there's less of that now than there was then, through COVID when everyone was stuck at home, there's still a lingering effect. And coupled with some bad years in the Netherlands where a lot of bulbs are grown, the prices went up quite substantially from that. So perhaps Australian growers didn't invest quite as much in new bulbs. And tulips are quite difficult to grow. Like they're a tough crop. We could have had better years, shall we say, in the last couple of years. But we, you know, we have other ways of filling those gaps as well. So
what makes them difficult to grow?
They're just really slow multipliers. So, and you're always using your seed stock from the year before. It's a bit like potentially garlic or something like that. So, you know, you plant one bulb and you might get two or three back of different sizes, of which one's a saleable size. And it just takes a long time to build up stocks. At the same time, you have sort of issues around growing tulips. So there's things like soil-borne fusariums, a big issue in tulips. There's tulips get botrytis, much like grapes, and things that can be quite devastating if you're unlucky to get a bad outbreak. There's some mites and things like that that are issues in tulips as well. And if you do have a bad year, it sort of means the next year is likely to be not great. And also quarantine, if you want to bring new bulbs into Australia, that's a huge, bit of a headache, but it's very important. And then all the infrastructure and specialty equipment needed for tulips is a big issue. We still have tulips for sale to our gardeners, but we're essentially out of tulips to our wholesalers right now.
How long has that been the case for?
It's not wholly unusual to be out of tulips at this time of year, but it is. We're out earlier this year than, yeah, we would have liked, shall we say. We could have sold more.
Right now, around Australia, there's no sector of farming that isn't touched by fuel and fertiliser. How's that affecting you here?
Yeah, so we've done, what all good farmers around the region have done is, stockpiled up on some fertiliser and driven the price up. You know, that's what everybody, I think, has done. So we've got a little bit here to work with. But the way we're thinking about it is, lime might be a cheap fertiliser this year compared to other things. So we're doing a liming program, more extensive than usual. We're also trying to look at fertiliser efficiencies. And so that's purely, so for our granular fertilisers like MAP, we'll be coating all of that with a humic acid. And then for urea, we're at this stage, because of the prices, we're primarily going to a foliar urea system, and we'll be mixing that with a humic substance as well to try to get, for every unit of N, 5+ times the efficiency of a granular N. So that's our plan. It'll be difficult to get the units on in foliar, but at least we'll have options. The other way we're looking at fertiliser is, and this sort of comes around to my Nuffield report and what I've done through my Nuffield, is around biology in the soil and biology in and around plants and how that can contribute to the quality and growing great crops. At the end of the day, whether you're putting on, biologically fertilisers or urea or MAP, or you're trying to get nutrition into a plant, either it's biologically derived or it's through direct uptake through the roots. So we're also looking at using methods to improve the efficiency for our crops.
Yeah, well, on that, your Nuffield study there, tell us about it and what it's found, where it's at.
Yeah, so I'm just finishing off my report at the moment. Thanks for bringing it up.
Sorry to distract you.
And so I was lucky enough to travel all around the world looking at what I describe as biological priming. So, how you can improve the biology in your system for production and resilience outcomes, and what farmers are doing all over the world. So it's really fascinating. It's really different in different areas. Say in Brazil, they are just a long way ahead of our thinking in Australia. They have, when they did work on rhizobia 40 years ago for their soybeans, they just didn't stop with the rhizobia bacteria. They just was like, okay, what else can help in the production system? And they've got a well-accepted suite of different biology to help with their cropping systems over there, whether that be for insects, nematodes, fungi, bacteria problems, or enhancing the good guys as well. And in Australia, we just don't really have that acceptance of those things. There's satellite populations of growers who are happy to buy and apply biology, but nothing like what the Brazilians do. Yeah, and then you've got people in France who are very much traditional about how they go about it. If they want to grow great soil, it's like, good soil management, low traffic, minimum till, cover crops, lots of cover crops, interspecies cropping, like cash cropping. It's all about these sort of traditional ways of bringing soil to life and reducing input needs. And so there's just so many interesting things that I saw on my trip, but there's many, many strong ideas. But probably the strongest idea that I've come back with is the idea that we're growing biology all the time through whenever you plant a seed, like there's biology encapsulated within that seed. It's evolutionarily like adapted to hold on to biology so it can colonize the root as it emerges. But the idea is that biology optimized, and is it optimized for our environment? And I think that's an area that we can really look at.
How are you expecting the tulips in particular to go this year, given, what you're doing with fertiliser, seasons, all the things that make a good crop?
I don't think there's any reason to think the crop will be any lesser at this stage. And we're making changes in nutrition and things that we hope will enhance the crop for this year. We're focusing more at timely applications of micronutrients and making sure things are right. Having said that, they've got to have their macros there when they need them too. So we're sort of not panicking about that side of things. We think we've got the ingredients we need to grow a right crop.
It's Dave Roberts-Thompson from Van Diemen's Quality Bulbs there at Table Cape chatting to Beck Pridham. It's 1:45. Have you had a banana today? Every day, Australians collectively eat around 5 million bananas. They're our country's most popular fruit. But Australian growers are fighting an application to allow imports from the Philippines, warning there's too great a risk of introducing diseases including MOCO, black sigatoka and banana freckle. At present, no fresh bananas are imported. Professor Andre Drenth from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation tells Jennifer Nichols there's good reason to keep it that way.
By far the cheapest and most effective way to control diseases is not having them in the first place. Prevention is much better than a cure often, but often we don't want to make the time, effort or make the resources available to actually spend on prevention. I've worked on banana diseases for about 15 years, and at some stage we sort of realized that a lot of diseases we don't have. We all grow globally the same variety, Cavendish. And we know a lot, I've traveled a lot overseas, seen a lot of exotic diseases, which we really need to keep out of Australia. So based on that, we started a research program on diagnostic of emerging and exotic diseases. Basically, we can detect them very quickly. We know how they spread. We look at how they could come into the country. What are the pathways of entry? And then we develop molecular diagnostics. So if a grower has any suspicion or we see anything, we can very quickly tell them, yes, this is an exotic, or no, this is just some other problem we already have. You can only prevent something if you really catch it early. It's like a fire. You need to really get in there early and extinguish it.
And there's some things where, you know, once it gets into your soil, you're done for in terms of that spot.
Yeah, some pathogens are airborne, so like black sigatoka in bananas goes on the leaves and spreads in the air. Something like Fusarium wilt, tropical race 4, that is soil-borne. So once it's in the soil, it's virtually impossible to eradicate.
The industry is quite progressive in Australia. How have they embraced what you've been developing for them?
Well, they've embraced that wholeheartedly, I would say, because they have realised, probably the hard way, they had an incursion of black sigatoka in Italy in 2001, which was eradicated in 2013. They had, in the Northern Territory, an incursion of freckle, another important banana disease, which was eradicated. So they know how important these diseases are overseas. Let's say black sigatoka in places like Costa Rica, they spray every week, 50 times a year. We don't have to do that. The benefits of that are enormous. So they really know that if we get those diseases, that the cost is enormous. Let's say if you buy a banana in Europe, and it comes from Latin America, a third is for the control of black sigatoka, the cost of that banana. So that is an enormous cost, but it also has environmental negatives associated with that, of course. A number of years ago, we worked out what we call exclusion benefit, because what is the benefit of not having a problem? Let's say you have an airbag in your car, you pay for it, but you hope you never use it. And this is the same here. So what is the benefit of not having black sigatoka? What's the benefit of not having a bacterial disease like MOCO? So we worked this out for all the major diseases, because we know how much it costs overseas, especially in Latin America, to control these diseases. So those benefits are enormous. So based on that, it has been calculated that we save the industry about 52 million. But our research is very cheap in comparison. So that leads to a very high return on investment. So for every dollar you invest, you would get 12 in return. But it also means that our industry can keep growing bananas in a cost-effective way with minimal environmental in health impacts, which is important.
And how does this research guide policy decision making on imports in a free trade environment?
There is two things. One, we can import banana plants, let's say, for breeding programs. They go to a very strict post-entry quarantine, so they get kept in a quarantine glass house. We test them for multiple diseases using our assays, and then after they've been found to be clean, so they come in as tissue culture, after 18 months they get released and they can be used, let's say, for breeding or for research or for, by growers. At the moment, no one imports bananas into Australia, because to keep this position of being free of some major pests and diseases, we need to ensure that we're not bringing these in with imports. There have been applications for imports into Australia, but you actually are allowed to bring bananas into Australia, but the conditions under which that takes place are that stringent that it does not make economic sense. So we do not have at the moment imports from other countries. Imports, we've seen in other industries, would increase the risk enormously for bringing in pests and diseases on a particular crop. So we do everything at the border to try to intercept that. And the other thing is for the industry themselves is awareness. If I go overseas, I would wear shoes in a banana farm somewhere else in Latin America. I leave my clothes and everything behind and then come back clean. See, that is important to really that we're not a pathway to bring it in ourselves. And that applies to tourists. So people need to be aware of the risk of bringing in non-intentional material which just is in their bag, or bringing fruit in which is not allowed.
That's Professor Andre Drenth from the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation. A spokesperson for the Federal Department of Agriculture says, as a member of the World Trade Organization, Australia is obliged to consider formal requests for imports from our trading partners, but will never compromise on biosecurity. We'll get the latest on cattle and sheep markets from Piranha next.
Grab the latest issue of Gardening Australia magazine and see this year's new roses. Choose a great small tree, grow peas and lettuce, and visit Rachel Ward at Home on the Farm. Gardening Australia from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
On ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, you're with Larissa Smith.
It's that time on a Wednesday when we check in with livestock reporter Richard Bailey. Afternoon, Richard.
G'day, Larissa.
How are you travelling?
Always well, thank you.
Yeah, that's good. How have cattle markets performed locally this week?
Yeah, we had bigger numbers of everything yesterday at Piranha, 203 trade and grown cattle, of which about 60% were cows. With the few extra numbers, yearling prices were just a bit cheaper. The best of the steers, 400 to 452 cents. The best of the heifers, 380 to 444. And then there were quite a few secondary cattle there, and they were pretty hard to shift, 320 to 410 cents a kilo, probably because people are going to have an opportunity on Thursday to buy other store cattle, I would think. The few grown steers and bullocks made 380 to 402 cents, and then there were 125 cows penned, and a big number of these were light and very lean cows. Just goes to show the season isn't fantastic everywhere in the state. Prime cows, heavy cows, were just a few cents cheaper. They made 324 to 350 cents. Leaner cows, 270 to 332. And very lean, 140 to 248 cents. But the majority of those leaner cows, you know, they're anywhere from sort of 250 to 300 cents a kilo, which I reckon is a pretty good result for those lean cows.
What about over in the sheep yards?
Okay, we had 2,528 lambs, which is 1,300 more than last week. This market was mainly made up of store lambs, huge number of them unfinished light lambs. It meant that there weren't a lot of really good quality trade and heavy lambs. And, you know, it's hard to get a line through them, but I reckon they were definitely cheaper. There's no doubt about that. But you've got to remember that it really was hardly worth the buyers having a good dip into them, because there just weren't enough of them. 242 up to a top of $320 a head for the best. Trade lambs, 222 to 242. Light trade, 160 to 188. And processors paid 100 to 172 for light lambs. First time for a few weeks we've had an MK buyer in the yards. In other words, a buyer buying for that light lamb job. That made quite a bit of difference because the store buyers weren't as active as we've seen. A bit of this happens because a lot of these lambs now have started to get, you know, inch and a half of wool on them. They were shorn back in December, and this means that these blokes that are buying these have got to go take them away and shear them again, and so they're not quite as keen, because when we got over to the lambs that were bare shorn or recently shorn, they were certainly strong again there. So they paid up to 140 to 186 for those sort of lighter lambs, and the very small lambs, $52 to $140. Then over in the mutton yard at 1,700 mutton, which is 900 more, this market was very, very strong. Heavy sheep, extra heavy sheep made $254 to a top of $304. Got over $300 about three or four times during the sale. Heavy sheep, 200 to 242. Medium weights, 152 to 204. And light sheep, $80 to $150 a head. Don't forget Piranha tomorrow, Larissa.
Yes, keep an eye out for that. And you'll have a full wrap of that market with Tony Briscoe on Friday.
Yeah, it looks like there'll be over 3,000 cattle there, so that'll be probably the biggest sale we've had for the autumn. So if you want cattle, it'll be a good place to go.
Is that the last one, Richard?
No, there's one. Elders and AWN have got one the following week.
Okay, too easy. Take care.
Got it. Cheers.
Livestock reporter Richard Bailey there. Let's find out what's happening on Afternoons with Joel Reinberger. Hey, Joel.
G'day there. How you doing?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Good, excellent. Now, today we're going to be catching up with Andrew Kelly from Truwana. I'm sure you've driven past Truwana Wildlife Sanctuary before.
Yeah, Mole Creek Way, isn't it?
That is right. It's impossible to miss. There is a gigantic yeah. devil statue coming out of the ground. It's the most frightening thing you've ever seen when you first come across it. But they're celebrating 40 years of operation. Andrew's staff kind of surprised him by figuring out this date and putting up a Facebook post about it, and he had no idea. He had no idea they were planning to do anything like that, so that's been snuck in on him. So I'm going to have a catch-up with Andrew and talk about, I mean, really the question that comes to me is how many litres of blood have you literally lost over doing this? When you,
yes, how many devils have latched onto your arm?
Yes. I went and visited there a few years back when I was in the area, and it was right in the middle of joey season where you had joeys popping out of pouches absolutely everywhere. And he, you know, he had a baby wombat to show me that had been, like its mum had been run over, and he had what looked like a giant beanie, but it was a specially knitted wombat pouch. And he went into the quoll cage and introduced me to this quoll mother. And, you know, it's just quietly gnawing on his finger while he's talking to me. Oh, don't do that, darling. What's that about?
And I wonder, you know, it takes a lot to keep these sanctuaries going, the cost,
yeah.
the feed. Yeah.
And look, they have kind of a stud book. Like they've been tracing genealogy and genetic lines of Tasmanian devils for generations and generations, for like I think it's 25 years or something they've been doing that. And so, you know, and it's the longest running similar, you know, book of genealogy in I think native animals in Australia. It's incredible the care he's kept with keeping those records, so when they deal with something like the devil facial tumor disease, they know what genetics they have. They know who the forebears are and who's immune and who's not and all that kind of thing. So, like a lot of scientific care being taken care of there and caring for the animals, obviously, but you've also got to be a zoo. Yeah. So there's a real balancing act, I think, to be done there as well. So, yeah, a chance up to catch up with a man who's been looking after our native creatures for 40 years this afternoon, on Afternoons.
Yeah, it sounds terrific. Thanks, Joel. We'll check in with you tomorrow, but your program's on at 1:30. Tony Briscoe back in the chair tomorrow for midday. It's news time now, 1 o'clock.
Where do you take the ABC Listen app?
On the train, of course.
Doing some gardening.
In the shower.
Take ABC Local Radio with you wherever you go with the ABC Listen app.